This episode is sponsored by Gopher State Tape Library, a 501(c) corporation. Established in 1974, the library has been archiving recovery talks of the many 12-step recovery fellowships across the globe. For almost 50 years, these have been distributed worldwide. The library is the only all-volunteer organization doing this work in existence. There are no paid employees. Thousands of downloads, MP3s, and CDs can be obtained at www.gstl.ecwid.com. The Gathering with Roger B. occurs monthly in Wayzata, Minnesota. Attendees are 12-steppers, those who have been affected by another's addiction, and some who are simply interested in improving their personal level of life satisfaction using a variety of spiritually-based tools. It is also used as a tool for study groups nationwide. The Gathering's talks are generally tied to one or more of the 12 steps, but are always guided by spiritual concepts, principles, and ideas common to most faiths. Topics are drawn from a variety of sources, the 12 steps, many of the well-known wisdom texts, science, and other teachers that speak to a spiritual solution to life's challenges. Roger has been in recovery for over 40 years and has spent thousands of hours in service, sharing his experience, strength, and hope. He has created curriculum for treatment centers and leads workshops and retreats throughout the United States and Canada. Roger is a spiritual director and offers insight into spiritually based living skills that are relevant to all people, whether in recovery or not.
We're going to talk about some recovery ideas. Understand, this is my disclaimer. I'm not appointed or anointed or endorsed by any organization or group. So this is just my experience. If it's useful, please use it. If it's not useful, just ignore it. That's what we're going to do there. Okay. You know, last night I was, because I don't premeditate these talks, and sometimes that's glaringly obvious, but last night I was over at the house in Wayzata. My wife, I took my son out for dinner and came back in, and she was meeting with one of her sponsees, and we were talking about unconditional happiness, and the idea came up about artificial intelligence. And I liked it because it's a way that I'm going to try and attempt to get a way to look at this thinking problem that we have in a different fashion. So I'll tell you, I'm going to do some little quick readings out of the big book to highlight the problem. If you're brand new, your problem is, I don't want to drink today. I don't want to pick up drugs. If you've been around a while, you realize what the book said, greatest symptom of a much bigger problem, the most acute symptom of a underlying problem that's much bigger. And that problem is described in some of our texts. In the doctor's opinion, he's talking about, you need a psychic change, you need a new mind, you know, you need a new set of values to operate from, but he didn't know how to create that. So, and there's a solution. Now we have the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, and there's a solution. There's a line here that's important. We feel, we is the we that wrote the book. We feel, this is page 19, the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. Much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs, in our relationship to the world. Our interior world and our exterior world. That's pretty clear. And then there's another one over here on page 23. Again, and there's a solution. They're talking about obsession and drinking, and the relapse occurs in our thinking, right? What happens is I get seduced into thinking this is an answer. To what? To my stress, to my loneliness, to my poverty, to my situation, exterior, interior. This has no power. But what this does is I start thinking about it. And I say, this doesn't represent police and court and tow trucks and cop cars. This represents peace. This represents power. This represents a way for me to get through another day, right? And we drink. And we repeat that cycle over and over until something happens that changes our approach, right? So they say, with the information you have, Roger, at your disposal, with your drinking history, it should be obvious the main problem of the alcoholic center is in the mind rather than the body. Because I can't have the phenomenon of craving until the booze is in my body. So everything that feels like a craving is really a mental obsession. I succumb to the obsession and off we go again. Then again, on page 25, the great fact is just this and nothing less. We've had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator, God, as you understand God, has entered into our hearts and enters into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. He, if you don't like the male pronoun, change it out. But the great fact is not that I stopped drinking. The great fact is that I found a power that can solve my living problem. So deep and effective spiritual experiences, those are personality shifts and changes, right? And those changes revolutionized my whole approach to life. Not towards drinking, not towards ice, not towards tequila, towards life, towards you, towards God's universe, in fact, to everything. So the central fact now is the absolute certainty that there's some power that's entered into my being, and that power is what's transformed me. So if I stay close to the power, it's like staying close to the fire, you stay warm. The further away from the fire you get, the colder you get. The closer I stay to God, the more I feel that power and that peace. The further away I get from God, the more lonely it is, right? So, if you're seriously alcoholic as we were, which is terminal, we believe there's no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, I got two choices. One, go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. Drink till you die. The other, to accept spiritual help. And here's the separator for the crowd. This we did because we honestly wanted to. Do I? And we're willing to make the effort. Am I? A lot of people that talk about wanting to do something but never do it, right? That's an important separator. There's another one. This is about the mentalist obsession. This is in Fred's story and more about alcoholism. I went to my hotel leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all. Now, this is a guy who has just came out of the hospital. Shortly before this, right? You see, the problem, the thought came. He did not have the ability to recognize the weight of that thought. He did not have a defense against that thought. Just a couple of drinks, that's all. And the rest of that thought is what could go wrong, right? So I'm trying to build a case for this. We're here in agnostics. Their summation, the lack of power, that was our dilemma. Where do we see that? In the first step. We admitted we were powerless over the substance. Then, in the second half of the first step, we admit we're powerless to manage our lives to our satisfaction. Everyone's a manager. That's not a problem. The question is, how happy are you with the outcome? How happy are you with the results? Huh. That's failure of management. So what we see there is not just powerlessness over the substance and the ability to run my life. We see the failure of self-reliance. Okay? You with me? Hope so. So then on page 51 in We Agnostics, leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. Then they show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God or this power or this mystery, this something, is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. What are they saying? The facts of the facts. When you understand where I came from and you understand where I am now, you will have to admit to yourself, something happened to that guy. I wonder what it was. Then he asked me and I tell him, and then we see if he wants to do anything about his situation. So that's the, I wanted to start with some groundwork out of the book, because the rest of this is going to be a different talk, a different reference point. But it speaks to this whole thinking problem. Okay? Ooh, I love this stuff. Yeah. So you and I, well, this is the mystery. Why am I the way I am? Why can't I do what other people do? Why can't I be okay with me? Why can't I just be able to put a day or two or a week or two or a month or two or a year or two that's a decent year? Here's why. We are created in the image of our creator, right? Like begets like. So we're born, and everything we need, we possess. When a baby is born, the baby is perfect. The baby doesn't come out with prejudice or attitudes. It'll have some personality maybe, but it doesn't have even a sense of itself. It's just there like a clean, empty slate. Okay? Here's the first interesting part in the creation. I'm going to talk about brains. And the primary job of the brain is to keep the organism alive. This is going to tie into this thing in meditation. We always say, I'm the observer, not the experience. I'm the observer. I'm not my thinking. That idea, this is how I'm going to build this case. So we're born with this thing called the limbic system, which is our emotional wiring, okay? That part of the brain processes our emotions and our memories. This system is 100% in place at birth. Our thinking, our wiring is fully developed, okay? So the problem is the cerebral cortex is the part of our brain that sorts and identifies labels, doesn't develop until we're around 12. So what does that mean? The cortex job is to draw meaning from what's going on. It loves to put things in order. It loves to organize. It loves to name, loves to codify, likes to label. It likes to quantify. It is a dualistic system. Okay. Now there's a third part, the amygdala. And the amygdala is connected to the memory. And so the amygdala is this little piece of our brain between the two hemispheres. And its job is to determine the threat level. That's where the fight, flight, or freeze reaction comes from. Now, all of the sensory data, sight, smell, touch, taste, hearing, all that data comes into the amygdala first. So here's the problem. One of them. Here's the problem. When I'm a little baby and a young baby, up until my maybe seven, eight years for sure, I can feel. All the feelings are there. The emotions are there. But I don't know how to think about what I'm feeling. So the brain starts making up stories to keep me safe, to keep the organism surviving. So fundamental questions for the child. Who am I in relationship to you? First thing I find out is who's mom, who's dad, okay? Do I please you? Am I safe with you? Do I have a place in the world? What's my place, right? Will I be fed, understood, cared for? So these are fundamental early life issues for that baby. They're not codified. They're in the DNA. They're not in their thinking because they can't think, but they can feel. You know when you're feeling, when you feel safe, you just, it's a vibe. You know, I feel safe. I feel safe with her. I feel safe with him, right? And so if you're going to grow, the first orientation is going to be to your parental units. That's where you're going to look for that approval, for that support, for that love. And if you have a family that doesn't function on a very high level, you're in big trouble. Show of hands, how many people grew up with active addiction in their homes? Okay. So you know what I'm talking about. When you grow up with active alcoholism or drug addiction, you're not growing up with Ozzy and Harriet. You know, it's a different, I'm dating myself, the Cosbys, whatever. The point is, that's where I'm going to learn who I am and what I'm about. So if I have a dad who's a yeller or a slapper, I'm going to realize really quickly, I'm going to internalize that's how you deal with problems. You yell at him. You hit at him. If I have a dad, I didn't. But if I had a dad who was physically abusive to his wife, I would learn that if, when you don't get along, you just slap her. Or if I had a mother who was drunk, it could be the opposites, you know? Mom and dad are always yelling, and then we end up with this fight. So what do you internalize? Not safe. Not safe. I don't have to write a paper on it. I intuitively do not feel safe. The birth of fear. And so now this thing. Wait a minute. So when I back up, so that's my fear component. Then I learn also, I get messages from the world around me, from my parents, starting with my parents and then neighbors, then school, that I'm just not quite good enough. I just don't quite measure up. No matter how hard I try, I'm just not quite, I'm not as good as Jenny. I'm not as good as Dan. Not as good as Susan. Not as good as Reiner. Just not as good. Report card shows it. So I'm on the quest to be good enough. So that's shame. I'm not good enough. That's a short version. The other, I'm filthy, I'm broken, I'm unredeemable. The umbrella is I'm unlovable. So that's the package that I'm going out into the world with. There's interesting data around this. It turns out our emotions impact our thinking more than our thinking impacts our emotions, because we're feeling creatures. And by God, if I feel it, it's what it is. You know, we saw that in the four-step inventory. If I think it's true, it's true. Whether it is or not is irrelevant. It says fancy to real. We don't care, right? So I've got this emotional package. My mom is not emotionally available, because she's worrying about my dad and the four kids she's trying to keep from kindling and having them have an accident. And my dad's off drinking and working his ass off. So he's not around. I mean, literally, when I was a little boy, my dad traveled for work. And when he'd leave town, I would lay in bed at night and cry thinking I did something that made my dad go away. Way before I had words or life experience or context for it, do you see? And so I begin to get, this thing starts out as a protective device and it ends up my prison. So this idea, I'm not my thinking, is really important, because what we develop is a thing, some people call it ego, I call it false self a lot, is this imagined me. Eckhart Eckhart Tolle calls it the mind made me. This mind makes up an image of what I am and what it, all of this world life is about. And that's what I buy as my image. So what drives that? Desire and fear. I got my goal list. There's my goal, by God. It doesn't matter what it is. For someone, it might be a PhD. For someone else, it might be a marriage. For someone else, it might be a dog. For someone else, it might be their own car. It could be anything. So the desire drives those instincts, social security and sex, to get to achieve the goal. And of course, the achievement of the goal is wrapped around this idea. I don't feel good enough, but when I achieve the goal, I'll feel better about me. And when you achieve the goal and you get enough money, you get the car, you get the girl, you get the guy, whatever the thing is, very quickly, instinctively, you realize didn't work, not enough. I don't stop and think because this doesn't allow me to stop and think maybe this is the wrong approach because it's the only approach because it's what I believe. I have these conditioned responses and experiences. I make up a story about it. I'm not safe and I'm not good enough. And then as soon as you convince your subconscious that that's a belief, a truth, it becomes that. It becomes a truth. Now go to the computer analogy. This is like operating software. So I've got input into my computer, the amygdala, that's going to sort everything and tell me how scared or how defensive I need to be. That's going to hook up with the cortex, which is going to say, have we had any experience like this before? And the cortex will go, oh, God, yes. Let me pull out that cap. Oh, my God, we've had that experience thousands of times. Okay. Then the amygdala and the cortex come up with the solution. We label that as a threat. And now we come up with our quiver, our set of possible reactions. And they all create worse situations than the situation itself. They all make it worse. That's our history. The answer to my problems creates more problems. And I don't know it. I can't see it. Because this false self, this ego that's raging over here, has convinced me that that's me. So I am not my thinking. So when you sit around now and you're early recovery or later in the years in your progress, you go, a thought comes by and you go, that's a crazy thought. Well, who said that was a crazy thought? Not the thought, because this thing wants me to believe all the craziness. When I said, that's a goofy thought, who's thinking that? The other, the I am, the divinity within us. The truth, the internal compass, the thing that does not have physical form, pure consciousness. That's what it is. That's who I am. That's who you are. And it gets obscured by all this crap, these messages we got when we were young, and then we practice them. Then they're unassailable. When something becomes my truth, here's my truth. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And I got an unlimited amount of evidence to prove that point. So that's a fixed idea. So when you come and say, there's a lot of good people in the world, my cynicism and sarcasm comes right to the front. Why? Because it can't be wrong. I get into AA. I have wrecked my life. Not metaphorically, literally. I've wrecked my life. I've wrecked my health. I've ruined or severely damaged every relationship, every person I've ever come in contact with. And I come and sit down with you guys and you say, well, we're in the business of finding a higher power that'll solve our problem. And I'm going, fixed idea. There is no God. That's the truth. Why am I so resistant to change? Why am I so resistant to change? The reason is, if I accept your approach or your opinion or your idea, then if I say, okay, there's a power greater than me, then that means I was wrong. And shame says we can't be wrong. We cannot be wrong. That's why I compulsively lie. Because I want to look better than I actually feel like I am. That's why I'm dishonest. Because shame says, if I tell you who I am, you'll reject me. You'll kick me to the curb. So it's the dawning of this idea. It happens when you meet, usually it's your sponsor, but not always. When you're sitting in a meeting or you're listening to it, or you're at a conference listening to speakers or listening to a CD, and someone says something and it hits you. It's the truth. It's the truth. You might say, I never thought of it that way. Or you might say, I've never heard that before. And what it is a recognition of the truth, capital T. And you can't recognize that unless it's in you. Do you get what I'm saying? I don't know that truth is in me because I'm busy over here in my false world, my make-believe, the mind-made world, thinking that's the real world. No, no, that's a projection of my fear and my shame. So here's a big idea. I am not that thinking. I'm not that thinking, and that's good because the doctor said I need to have a new mind. AA says I need to be transformed, not around my drinking, in total. It says willingness, honesty, don't minors are the keys to that. They're indispensable. It also says that you can't do this if you close your mind to all spiritual concepts. It also says that the only thing that can defeat you and me is our attitude. That's your approach. Your attitude comes from this. Comes from my ideas, my beliefs, my truths, my experience. So I grew up with a really negative, glass half empty way of looking at the world. And it was right. It was true for me. Because you know this from your own experience. You can take any position you want and you can find evidence for it. There's a Henry Ford quote that kind of speaks to that. If you think you can, you're right. And if you think you can't, you're right. Because it's all attitude. It's not 10%. There's not luck here. It's approach. And the failure of my life, what I see in my four step, what I see in the quality of the people in my life when I'm drinking and first coming in is a reflection of what's going on in here. The reason I have people around me that are crooks and unreliable and liars and cheats and thieves is because that's what I am. And so I draw more of the same to me. There's a comfort in that. It's the same metaphor like kids in gangs. They're in the gang because they feel comfortable. They're getting the stuff from the gang that they didn't get from home, if they had a home. So I'm not my thinking. I'm that which is watching the thinking. A really great example. I love this. In Bill's story, you know, he's in the hospital and he has that white light experience. We call it the white light experience. Profound experience and presence of God. Clean wind blew. He was lifted up and put in a whole new place, right? So profound, he thought he was losing his mind. He calls Silkworth and Silkworth says, I don't know what's happened, but it's better than what you had. I'd stick with that. Right. Then the next paragraph, he says, the thought came. Perhaps there are thousands of people like me who would like to have what was so freely given to me. That's pure altruism and love. But the key is the thought came. He didn't say, I came up with this idea. The thought came because he created space in his consciousness for a new thought to arrive. Then God could talk to him with what? Through his thinking, through his ideas, through Silkworth, through other people, through Ebby, right? But not till the mind opens, because the mind is the gatekeeper. The mind is the gatekeeper. And I bought it. I need to find it. I need to get a new mind. But now it's the challenge, isn't it? There's a quote by George Bernard Shaw that I really like. All progress requires change. And then it says, if you can't change your thinking, you can't change anything. The resistance you and I have to the steps is not the steps. It's the ego. It's the false self's resistance to change. Because if I change, then the fear and the desire and the shame and the guilt can't run my life. And the false self, the ego, is out of business. It's not that the ego has to be destroyed. The ego is also the thing that's reaching for the God idea. Just a different spectrum of the ego. It's not that the ego is bad. It's just there's a part of my ego that's not well. And I didn't know there was another part to my ego. So it's not about banishing or destroying or killing the ego. It's about getting it in right proportion so it serves us instead of we serving it. So then I take that striving, that ego, striving to have this spiritual experience, and I use it, and it comes out. I study. I read. I talk to people. I practice some different things. Oh, different actions based on different thoughts. Because the actions, if I just change the actions, that's conformity, compliance. That won't sustain me indefinitely. There's an expression. I just ran into it tonight with some guy who was texting me. It's an old Chuck Chamberlain saying. You can act your way into right thinking, but you can't think your way into right acting. And when I came in, that was tantamount to fake it till you make it, which I didn't. I just didn't like it. I didn't understand it. But when I look back at my story now with some historical perspective, like 10, 15 years in, I look back, that's exactly what I did. I changed my behavior and my thinking came along after. Because I conform my behavior to a different set of ideas, principles, not wholesale, one or two at a time. One or two at a time. And the pain was always the disciplinarian. And then it would take me to the next surrender, the next I give up. And surrender always feels like dying. Because it is. It's dying to self. It's dying to that false me that's been created mistakenly. This is the other thing that gets us off the hook, you know? I'm a bad actor. Well, I came by it honestly. I didn't come out of this thing when I was five thinking, can't wait to be dead by 30 and screw everything up in my life that I could possibly do. No, I had hopes and dreams and aspirations, but I didn't know how to execute. I didn't know the proper principles to inform that. And then I got duped into this idea. My salvation, my happiness, my purpose, my value is out here in the world. Prove to them, be a success. What's your formula for success? Well, everyone in our family has advanced degrees. Go get an advanced degree. Great. I was working with a surgeon, one of the top 100 surgeons in the country, drinking himself to death. Well, I guess that wasn't too successful. It doesn't matter. It doesn't care what color you are. It doesn't care how much money you make. It doesn't care if you went to school or you never went to school. It doesn't give a crap about any of that. It just wants to own you. It wants to own you. And the it is, it turns out it's alcoholism, but it's really acute, selfish, self-centered fear. And we were just mistaken. We were just little boys and girls. There was no way to know. There was no way to know. And the other piece of that is my parents were woefully inadequate in some areas and incredibly abundant in other areas. And I couldn't see that until I got older. They did the best they could with the resources they had. Okay. So let it go. The reason I've got the resentments against my parents is it justifies my martyrdom. If I can blame all of you for my condition, then I have no responsibility. I'm just nailed to the wall. Till all of you come and beg my forgiveness and help me get the nails out of my hands, then we can't do any business, right? So those are some thoughts. This I am not my thinking. So what I've got is a computer. To come back to that metaphor, you know about algorithms. Those are those things that when you're on your Facebook thing and you happen to look at an ad for a Mexican vacation, all of a sudden Mexican vacation ads start popping up everywhere on your phone or on your computer because they have algorithms. They're watching what you do. They compare your behavior to what they have to sell you and they feed it to you. That's exactly what the false self is doing. I think the world's not a safe place. It says, well, let me help you prove that. And it goes out and it gathers all the information to prove that it's not a safe place. So what happens is these are programs that are running. Habituated reactions. Now we're back to the amygdala. The amygdala's learned when A, B, and C are present, run away. When A and B are present, get a hammer. When A is present, you might be able to blow it off. And then the cortex says, oh, God, we've had so much of this crap in our lives. We've had 1,000 of those. We got 950 of those incidences. We got, yes, we're not safe. All true from that one perspective. But the ego doesn't want me, the false self, the computer program doesn't want me to know there are other programs available. There are programs you can edit these programs with. Metaphorically, that's what we're doing, the steps. We're editing our programming. We're editing our thinking with new ideas and new approaches, new principles. And that fashions our thinking in a different direction, which informs our behavior.
New episodes of The Gathering are published twice a month and can be found on Spotify and other major podcast apps. You can follow The Gathering on Spotify and others to receive monthly notifications of new episodes.